Radio. Coming up is the news.
Leader tells the visiting Sultan of Oman that regional countries should be aware of the Israeli policy to create discord in the region. No end in sight to Israeli violence in the West Bank as regime forces kill more Palestinians during raids in the occupied territory. And the Turkish president calls for unity after winning the runoff vote as the defeated opposition leader complains of what he calls the most unfair election in recent years. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyed Khamenei, says all-out expansion of ties with Oman will benefit both countries. Ayatollah Khamenei says Tehran and Muscat should continue their negotiations with seriousness to get tangible results that lead to expanded relations. The leader made the comments in a meeting with the visiting Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq. Ayatollah Khamenei also underlined the significance of increased cooperation between Iran and Oman, seeing how they share what he called the very important Strait of Hormuz. The leader also warned about the risk posed by Israel in the region, saying the regime and its supporters seek discord among regional countries. Ayatollah Khamenei also hailed the Iranian government's efforts to improve relations with regional countries, including Saudi Arabia. He noted that Iran is also open to the restoration of ties with Egypt. Earlier during the meeting, the Sultan of Oman said that Egypt was willing to restore diplomatic ties with Iran. He also said that Muscat seeks closer cooperation with neighboring countries, especially Iran. Earlier, we were joined by John Ross, who is a senior fellow at the Chang Yang Institute for Financial Studies in China. He explained the importance of the Iranian visit by the Sultan of Oman.
Well, I think it's both the importance of the individual visit, but it's also a tendency of whole trend which is taking place, particularly in West Asia, but it's taking place in other parts of the world at the present time, which is a number of countries are strengthening their cooperation and deciding they don't want to pursue policies of de facto of the United States of isolating countries like Iran or China or Russia. I thought there was a very interesting article which appeared in the Financial Times called the Hour of the Global South, by which it meant not merely developing countries, I think, but also a political thing, that an increasing number of countries are refusing to go along with the attempts of the United States to unilaterally impose things on the world. So I think it's both an important visit in itself, and it also is part of a trend which is going on in the world, and that's why it attracted so much attention.
Two Palestinians succumbed to injuries after being shot by Israeli forces in the raids in the occupied West Bank. One of the Palestinians lost his life after he was critically injured in an incursion into the city of Jenin. The raid triggered confrontation with locals, where seven others were also wounded. The other Palestinians succumbed to injuries sustained in an Israeli raid in Al-Khalil 2 days ago. Earlier today, regime forces also carried out a separate raid in a village near Ramallah. They shot and injured two Palestinians there. The regime has intensified its crackdown across the occupied territories in recent months. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank alone this year. The Israeli regime has carried out yet another airstrike on Syria, this time targeting positions in the capital, Damascus. A number of explosions were heard shortly before midnight local time. The Syrian military says the country's air defenses responded to the attacks using anti-aircraft. It says the attacks only caused some material damage. The strikes were the first on Damascus since late March. The last Israeli raid on Syria in early May left seven people dead in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The Israeli regime routinely carries out airstrikes on Syria. Syrian officials have for a number of times called on the UN to force the Israeli regime to stop its aggression. They say that the move is in violation of international law. Our correspondent to Damascus, Mohammed Ali, says Israeli airstrikes in Syria are aimed at helping the remainder of the terrorists who have been fighting the Syrian army over the past years.
No one was killed or injured, and definitely this is not the first attack of its kind. We don't know for sure or in particular what was exactly targeted, but it seems that there were some military positions for the Syrian army around the Syrian capital. The Israeli side, as usual, did not comment on the issue, but tens if not hundreds of attacks by Israel have been carried out since the start of the crisis. And the Syrian government, especially the foreign ministry officials, always stress that those attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria. It's also worth mentioning that every time there has been a military advancement for the Syrian army against terrorists on the ground, we used to see similar Israeli attacks. And those attacks this time come following political achievements for Syria, especially following Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League summit, following the reconciliations from the Arab world with Syria. So some analysts believe that those attacks are actually indirect support of those remaining terrorist groups in Syria, that Israel's wanted to say to them that we are still back.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wins re-election in Sunday's runoff vote, extending his rule into its third decade. With over 99% of the ballot boxes opened, Erdogan garnered more than 52% of the votes. His rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu received nearly 48%, trailing Erdogan by more than 2 million votes. The country's Supreme Election Council says the uncounted ballots will not change the results. After he was declared the winner, Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters outside of the presidential palace in the capital, Ankara. He called on Turks to unite in favor of the country's national goals.
It's time to unite and unify around our national goals and national dreams, leaving aside all discussions and disputes regarding the election period.
Erdogan also says the election is Turkey's most important in the modern era, adding the entire nation is the winner. The opposition leader, Kılıçdaroğlu, has not explicitly conceded defeat. He says the election was the most unfair in recent years and that Erdogan's party mobilized all the means of the state against him. However, he thanked people who voted for him. Dr. Can Erimtan, independent historian and geopolitical analyst, joins us from Berlin. And we have Mr. Farshid Bagharian, political analyst, who joins us from Karaj here in the Islamic Republic. All right, let me start with our first guest, Dr. Erimtan, and ask you two issues I think would be at the top of the list if you agree, or if you're not. If you don't, let us know. And that is, I think, the economy, given the position that the lira is in particular, and of course then comes the foreign policy arena. Do you think that Erdogan is up to the task of moving forward, especially when it comes to the economy, in order for at least the population at large in Turkey to feel some reprieve when it comes to things like inflation?
Well, in my opinion, Erdogan and his AKP, his AK Party, they have put mind over matter. Such trivialities like the economy or people's happiness do not seem to be their primary concern. In my opinion, their primary goal is the furthering of their of what I have termed about 10 years ago a policy of unification, namely to transform the Turkish Republic not into a nation state but into an Islamic state. And for that reason, it is always mind over matter, and the reality on the ground may be disadvantageous at this moment in time, but he will just try to muddle on and then eventually hope to get on top. But his main aim and goal is, in my opinion, to transform the Turkish Republic into an Islamic state and to totally dismantle the legacy of Atatürk and erase any trace of communism in the country.
Okay, just to make sure that I heard the terminology correct, you said from a nation state to an Islamic state, is that what you said?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Mr. Bagharian, so obviously for the Islamic Republic, Turkey is a very important country in terms of its relation. Tell us the regional movements forward for Turkey when it comes to countries like Iran and also Syria and any other countries regionally that you think are important now that Erdogan has been reelected.
Thank you very much. Of course, the runoff vote shows that Mr. Erdogan is extending his power for more than 5 years, but this kind of power is not same as before, because after two decades of the power, I mean the top of the power, Mr. Erdogan himself orchestrated many kind of problems that right now he's facing this problem. The one of these most tough problems is Syria border, because you know Mr. Erdogan was in mind that it was some kind of the irredentism and devastating of the Turkish empire, metaphysical empire, but devastating in the Syria region. But right now Syria is a member of the powerful Arab League, and any problem with Syria is considered right now with a problem with the Arab League. So Mr. Erdogan, by means of the Syria, facing another type of the problem. The other problems, I believe that the first problem should be the economic problem, because the rate of the interest, the migration, and the unemployment, it would be the very toughest problem for Mr. Erdogan that can not rule easily in the region. He must involve first of all involve with the domestic problems. It means that for the coming months, more than maybe 6 or 7 months, he must try to find the financial and the liquid for the recovering the financial problem. After that, maybe Mr. Erdogan can consider what would be happen in the region. So the first problem is economic, is not the region itself for Mr. Erdogan. This is for your first question. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Farshid Baghdadian, political analyst, and also Dr. Ken Ermtan, independent historian and geopolitical analyst from Berlin. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Ukraine says it has repelled another major airstrike on the capital, Kiev, one day after Russia unleashed its largest drone attack on the city so far. Officials said that air defenses intercepted over 40 drones and cruise missiles overnight. No damage or casualties have been reported. On Saturday, a similar volley of attacks killed 2 people and wounded 3 others in Kiev. Ukrainian military authorities have counted 15 airstrikes on the city only this month. The intensified fighting in Kiev comes after a lull of nearly 2 months. The main targets are military facilities and supplies. Russia has also warned the West against providing more advanced weapons to Ukraine, including F-16 fighter jets. Pro-Palestinian campaigners gather in the Belgian capital to call for EU sanctions against the Israeli regime. However, analysts say the 27-nation bloc's unwavering support for Tel Aviv will remain unchanged unless the U.S. alters its position. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for 3/4 of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes, we feel. And we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French police brutality against protesters continues to occur, and one group which knows plenty about that subject are the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters. They still gather every Saturday nationwide and do so despite regular harassment by police and judges. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's Yellow Vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Chaque samedi, bientôt cinq ans.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries. The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a Yellow Vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy is why the Yellow Vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the Yellow Vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
I will keep thinking and worrying about idealism if there is no hope. And rationality is the steering wheel for this engine. You must think rationally, act wisely, and move forward. As for universities, I have much to say about them. You also spoke about them, and what you said is correct. The problems you mentioned exist. What I want to say is that the lack of a truly comprehensive scientific plan is a great shortcoming in our universities today. We don't know what basis is used for the distribution of students in various scientific fields of study. These scientific courses of study should be in fields that are needed in the country. They must benefit the country. How many students do we need in a certain field? These matters should be considered, and work needs to be done on this. I'd like to ask the Honorable Minister of Science, he's probably among us here, to pursue this matter. It is one of the important tasks that you need to do.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are some fields of study that aren't even needed in Iran. There aren't any jobs in these fields either. Well, what's the point? There is no point in carrying out certain academic activities or attending certain academic courses. Perhaps we have several hundreds of thousands of high school graduates who are able to work in different sectors right now. But instead, we bring them into the university environment, and after a while, we turn over a few hundred thousands angry, demanding, unemployed people with a bachelor's or master's degree to the country. Let's think about what we need and take action according to our needs. If we have a university graduate who doesn't have a job, you should know that there is a problem with our educational system. If someone studies a field of study in order to be able to benefit his or her country, their job must be ready. If we have a graduate, but he does not have a job, it is clear that this student's enrollment was not done systematically based on correct calculations. Well, our time is up and there is still much to be said. I like you and I pray for you. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It's a moment that will surely be marked in history books. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, being welcomed back to the Arab League after an 11-year absence, an absence that was forced on it due to the war in Syria by Daesh terrorists, were supported by some of the very same countries present at the summit. Now times have changed, and all countries in the region have normalized ties with Syria. The U.S. support for Daesh terrorists was not so much a quest for democracy for Syrians, as the U.S. stated, but more of an obsession to oust the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. So for U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the rest of the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, even Jordan, to embrace the Syrian president is surely a slap in the face of the U.S. Just like how Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciled after years of hostility, another colossal event which, according to the CIA director, the U.S. was blindsided by this major development. U.S. blindsided by Iran-Saudi rapprochement surely puts into question the weak level of U.S. intel on the ground in West Asia, but not accepting these realities just makes the U.S. isolated and detached from reality. As such, the U.S. is reacting, and true to U.S. behavior, it is doing so against international law. It has been reported that the U.S. has started to build a new military base in the northern province of Raqqa. When it comes to the U.S. illegal occupation of Syria, there are currently at least 24 U.S.-led coalition military sites spread throughout Syria's northeast. The largest base housing U.S. troops is the Al-Omar Field. The oil field in Deir al-Zour province is Syria's largest and has a presence of U.S. personnel and the YPG-PKK terrorist group. Then there is the Al-Tanf, also known as the Al-Tanf Garrison. It is a U.S. military base, but the territory is controlled by the so-called Syrian opposition in Homs Governorate. Overall, the U.S. is occupying roughly a third, or 33%, of Syrian territory. What are U.S.'s main goals in Syria? Brett McGurk, the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, said the U.S. had four main objectives in Syria: to reduce violence, maintain military pressure on Daesh, address Syria's humanitarian crisis, and to support Israel. Except for the last goal, the U.S. has not achieved any of those stated aims. The U.S. stated goal of eradicating Daesh terrorists rings hollow. For starters, how could the U.S. not eliminate about 1,000 Daesh terrorists since the year 2016, when they first occupied Syrian soil? That is because they are using these terrorists against the Assad government, with the outdated notion of regime change. There are also reports that the U.S. trains these terrorists to use them in places like Afghanistan or other countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. is also stealing Syrian oil and selling it in the black market to provide finances for the YPG Kurdish forces and also for forces inside Iraq, since, in terms of the YPG Kurdish forces, they had supported them with the promise of partitioning an area for them in northern Syria. But the real purpose of the U.S. presence in Syria, as it has stated, to support Israel with the aim of targeting Iran, who is in Syria with the consent of the Syrian government. Both the U.S. and Israel need a wake-up call. The geopolitical shifts in the region have proven one thing: there is no need for the U.S. presence there. All countries have normalized with each other, except for maybe Yemen and Saudi Arabia, who are on course to do so. And when it comes to the security of the region, after Iran and Saudi Arabia's normalization, there is a united front that has been formed, where regional countries have stated that they will ensure their own security. There may have been a time when countries like Saudi Arabia may have sought U.S. assistance and even paid them to provide it with their security, which also included weapon sales, but those days are over. Also gone are the days when the U.S. created Iranophobia to scare regional countries into buying U.S. weapons, with the false notion that Iran was a bad actor. West Asian countries have realized that it is the U.S. and Israel who are now the bad actors in the region. This warning to the U.S. military by the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Navy, perhaps states it best when he said, "You are damn wrong to be in our region." A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. The countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the US and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly, now the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq and obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And they say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West's proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgrade region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western Military District units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morope during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's defense forces' capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morope, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law, is mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world as we live today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister, James Morope, said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island. Morope also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggested Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Morope of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang from the People's National Congress said last week, "We should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run." He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none.
In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان
Self purification is the most significant factor
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
سی سال پیش یه کار خیر کرده واسه یه بنده خدایی. سی سال هم از داره میگه.
Sometimes we did a good deed a long time ago and still we tell its story here and there. Telling the story of our good deeds to others boastfully removes sincerity from our actions and we degrade it to an insincere one. The late Ayatollah Shaykh Hasan Ali Tehrani is a good example for those who want to learn sincere action. For 16 years, he used to help a poor but good student of him without saying a word about it. When the Ayatollah passed away and the money was cut, the student recognized the true helper during all these years. The late Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani, one of the most famous ulama of Tehran, had always advised me to talk about practical, ethical, and moral virtues in life, even if it was the day of Ashura. He believed that some people only have time for special religious occasions, and they spend their time in holy shrines or mosques to benefit spiritually. One such practical virtue is sincerity of action. Sincerity is the best spiritual investment to save us from the hellfire in the other world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Over the past few decades, Muslims in the West and elsewhere have allied with leftist movements in the struggle against war, imperialism and racism, among other just causes. But on today's show, we're going to ask how far should these alliances go and could they dilute authentic Islamic activism? Before we get into the discussion, let's take a look at the context to this story.
In recent years, Muslim activism in the Western world has found a home for itself in the political left. As a minority, Muslims in America and Europe routinely face discrimination, racism, and Islamophobia, sometimes institutional, sometimes on a street level. So naturally, many Muslims began working alongside anti-racism, anti-establishment groups, pushing for better quality for the less privileged. But it was the West's war on terror and the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan which truly forced Western Muslims into the arms of a thriving, left-wing-led anti-war movement, condemning imperialism in all its forms.
How many years will it take the world to put this right?
Historically, however, Islam and left-wing politics have been at odds. The former USSR caused wide upset across the Ummah for supporting secularism in the Arab world and for the later invasion of Afghanistan. Communism, too, is a political ideology infamous for its hostility to all religion, routinely described as an atheist movement. The left, in general, remains popular with many atheists. In more recent times, Western Muslims who pursue political careers are routinely condemned for abandoning Islamic principles to seemingly fit in with left-wing party politics. America's Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, UK Labour's Sadiq Khan and Zahra Sultana, and Scotland's Hamza Yousaf remain prominent examples of left-wing Muslims who have received criticism from their own community. Popular causes associated to the left include the LGBT cause, radical feminism, trans activism, atheism and wokeism, concepts which are at odds with Islam. How Muslims can balance this relationship and remain loyal to their religious obligations is becoming an increasingly important debate amid a growing culture war.
Joining us today to talk about the left in the UK, we have Amar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. Also joining us today, we have Mizan Rahman, also known as Mizan the Poet, a British Bengali campaigner and anti-racist activist who specialises in disentangling and disseminating the processes and policies used against oppressed communities in the UK through workshops and articles. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Amar, let me come straight to you. I want to ask you about your experiences with the left. You've been very active in left-wing circles for quite some time now, but right now I think that there's a kind of issue where a lot of Muslims feel, like they're politically homeless and even persecuted in some cases in the left here in the UK specifically. Just tell me, what's your experience has been like?
Well, I was a member of the Labour Party for 6 years during the Corbyn period and just the first year, I think, year and a half of Keir Starmer's leadership. So it was a time of great political struggle. I think lots of Muslims allied themselves with Jeremy Corbyn and saw an avenue to support issues that are important to Muslims like Palestine through and under his leadership. But I found that the left in general seems to have a problem with practicing Muslims. And that's not often understood because, you know, from the left's perspective, they would perceive themselves to be on our side, to be with us. They support, you know, the underdog, they're anti-racists. And actually, I found that that's kind of an aesthetic thing. They seem to enjoy having Muslims to, you know, support a coalition of the oppressed, if you like. You know, of course, there was a time, you know, about 20 years ago when the left supported Muslims in terms of opposing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and during the war on terror. But at that point in time, anti-imperialism, a genuine anti-imperialism, I think, was something that really existed on the left. Now that's been smashed as a result of propaganda campaigns and the successful work, in my view, of Western intelligence agencies. And we find now, in this current juncture, Muslims, practicing Muslims, tend to be quite unwelcome in these leftist spaces when they express views that support things like Islamic resistance, Islamic anti-imperialism, you know, Muslim views.